owner of the London Chronicle, since 1743. When Strawn provided a letter of recommendation for his apprentice, David Hall, whom Franklin hired and later made his partner. They had exchanged more than 60 letters before they even met, and when they finally did, Strawn was smitten by the larger-than-life Franklin. "I never saw a man who was in every respect so perfectly agreeable to me," he wrote Deborah Franklin. "Some are amiable in one view, some in another, he in all." Collinson, the merchant with whom he had corresponded about electricity, introduced Franklin to the Royal Society, which had already elected him its first American member a year before he arrived. Through Collinson, he met Dr. John Fothergill, one of London's foremost physicians, who became his doctor and helped advise him on dealing with the pens, and also Sir John Pringle, a crusty Scottish professor of moral philosophy and later royal physician, who became his traveling companion. Collinson also brought him into the Honest Whigs, a discussion club of pro-American liberal intellectuals. Among its members, Franklin befriended Joseph Priestley, who wrote the history of electricity that secured Franklin's reputation and went on to isolate oxygen, and Jonathan Shipley, the Bishop of St. Asaph, at whose home Franklin would write much of his autobiography. Franklin also got in touch with the wayward friend of his youth, James Ralph, who had been his companion on his earlier trip to London, during which they had a falling out over money and a woman. Ralph's character hadn't changed much. Franklin carried from Philadelphia a letter to Ralph written by the daughter he had abandoned, who was now the mother of 10 children. But Ralph didn't want his own English wife and daughter to learn of his connections to America, so he refused to write back. He merely told Franklin to pass along his great affection. Franklin had little to do with Ralph after that. For the fashionable gentlemen of the aristocracy, elegant eating and gambling clubs, such as White's and later Brooks's and Boodle's, were starting to spring up in St. James's. For the burgeoning new class of writers, journalists, professionals, and intellectuals whose company Franklin preferred, there were the coffee houses. London had more than 500 at the time. They contained newspapers and periodicals for the patrons to read, and tables around which discussion clubs could be formed. Fellows of the Royal Society tended to meet at the Grecian Coffee House in the Strand, just a short walk from Craven Street. The Club of Honest Whigs met on alternate Thursdays at St. Paul's Coffee House. Others, such as the Massachusetts and Pennsylvania coffee houses, provided an American connection. Franklin, always fond of clubs and the occasional glass of Madeira, frequented these and others. And thus he created an embracing new set of friends and hangouts that replicated the joys of the Junto and provided him with a modest power base among the city's intellectuals. But it was, as Thomas Penn had predicted, a somewhat limited power base. The proprietor had reassured his own allies after Franklin's appointment that he might find favor among those who cared about his scientific experiments. But these middle-class Whiggish intellectuals were not the ones who would decide Pennsylvania's fate. "There are very few of any consequence that have heard of his electrical experiments, those matters being attended to by a particular set of people," Penn wrote. "But it is quite another sort of people who are to determine the dispute between us." Indeed it was. Battling the Pens. Franklin came to London not only as a loyalist to the crown, but as an enthusiast for the empire, of which he felt that America was an integral part. But he soon found out that he labored under a misconception. He believed that His Majesty's subjects, who happened to live in the colonies, were not second-class citizens. Instead, he felt they should have all the rights of any British subject, including that of electing assemblies with legislative and tax-writing powers similar to those of Parliament. The Penns might not see it that way, but certainly the enlightened British ministers would, he believed, help him pressure the Penns to revise their autocratic ways. That is why it was a rude surprise to Franklin when shortly after his arrival he met Lord Granville, the president of the Privy Council, the group of top ministers who acted for the king. "You Americans have wrong ideas of the nature of your constitution," Lord Granville said. "The instructions given to colonial governors were the law of the land, and colonial legislatures had no right to ignore them." Franklin replied that this was new doctrine to me. The colonial charters specified that the laws were to be made by the colonial assemblies, he argued. Although the governors could veto them, they could not dictate them. "He assured me that I was totally mistaken," recalled Franklin, who was so alarmed that he wrote the conversation down verbatim as soon as he returned to Craven Street. Franklin's interpretation had merit. Years earlier, Parliament had rejected a clause that would give the power of law to governors' instructions. But the rebuke from Granville, who happened to be an in-law of the Penns, served as a warning that the proprietor's interpretation had support in court circles. A few days later, in August 1757, Franklin began a series of meetings with the primary proprietor, Thomas Penn, and his brother Richard. He was already acquainted with Thomas, who had lived for a while in Philadelphia, and even had bookplates printed at Franklin's shop, though Franklin's account books show he did not pay all of his bills. Initially, the sessions were cordial. Both sides proclaimed their desire to be reasonable. But as Franklin later noted, "I suppose each party had its own idea of what should be meant by reasonable." The Penns asked for the Assembly's case in writing, which Franklin produced in 2 days. Entitled Heads of Complaint, Franklin's memo demanded that the appointed governor be allowed use of his best discretion, and it called the proprietor's demand to be exempt from the taxes that helped defend their land unjust and cruel. More provocative than its substance was the informal style Franklin used. He did not address the paper to the Penns directly or use their correct title of True and Absolute Proprietaries. Offended by the snub, the Penns advised Franklin that he should henceforth deal only through their lawyer, Ferdinand John Paris. Franklin refused. He considered Paris a proud, angry man who had developed a mortal enmity toward him. The impasse served the proprietor's ends. For a year, they avoided giving any response while waiting for legal rulings from the government's lawyers. Franklin's famous ability to be calm and congenial abandoned him at a rancorous meeting with Thomas Penn in January 1758. At issue was Penn's right to veto the Assembly's appointment of a set of commissioners to deal with the Indians. But Franklin used the meeting to assert the broader claim that the Assembly had powers in Pennsylvania comparable to those that Parliament had in Britain. He argued that Penn's revered father, William Penn, had expressly given such rights to Pennsylvania's Assembly in his 1701 Charter of Privileges, granted to the colonists. Thomas replied that the royal charter held by his father did not give him the power to make such a grant. If my father granted privileges he was not by the royal charter empowered to grant, Penn said, nothing can be claimed by such a grant. Franklin replied, If then your father had no right to grant the privileges he pretended to grant and published all over Europe as granted, those who came to settle in the province were deceived, cheated, and betrayed. The royal charter was no secret, Penn responded. If they were deceived, it was their own fault. Franklin was not entirely correct. William Penn's 1701 charter in fact declared that the Pennsylvania Assembly would have the power and privileges of an assembly according to the rights of the free-born subjects of England, and as is usual in any of the king's plantations in America, and thus was subject to some interpretation. Franklin was nevertheless furious. In a vivid description of the row, written to Assembly Speaker Isaac Norris, Franklin used words that would later, when the letter leaked public, destroy any chance he had to be an effective lobbyist with the proprietors. Penn spoke with a kind of triumphing, laughing insolence, such as a low jockey might do when a purchaser complained that he had cheated him in a horse. I was astonished to see him thus meanly give up his father's character, and conceived at that moment a more cordial and thorough contempt for him than I have ever before felt for any man living. Franklin found his face growing warm, his temper starting to rise. So he was careful to say little that would betray his emotions. I made no other answer, he recalled, than that the poor people were no lawyers themselves, and confiding in his father, did not think it necessary to consult any. The venomous meeting was a turning point in Franklin's mission. Penn refused any further personal negotiations, described Franklin as looking like a malicious villain, and declared that from this time I will not have any conversation with him on any pretense. Whenever they subsequently ran into one another, Franklin reported, there appears in his wretched countenance a strange mixture of hatred, anger, fear, and vexation. Abandoning his usual pragmatism, Franklin began to vent his anger to allies back in Pennsylvania. My patience with the proprietors is almost, though not quite, spent, he wrote his Pennsylvania ally, Joseph Galloway. He was, along with his son, preparing to publish a history of the Pennsylvania disputes, one in which the proprietors will be gibbeted up as they deserve, to rot and stink in the nostrils of posterity. Franklin's ability to act as an agent was thus pretty much over, at least for the time being. He was, nevertheless, still able to provide his Philadelphia friends with inside intelligence, such as advance word that the Penns were planning to fire Governor William Denny, who had violated his instructions by allowing a compromise that taxed the proprietary estates. It was to have been kept a secret from me, he wrote Deborah, adding, with a bit of poor Richard's wit, so you may make a secret of it too, if you please, and oblige all your friends with it. He also was effective, as he had been since a teenager, at using the press to wage a propaganda campaign. Writing anonymously in Strawn's paper, the London Chronicle, he decried the actions of the Penns as being contrary to the interests of Britain. A letter signed by William Franklin, but clearly written with the help of his father, attacked the Penns more personally, and it was reprinted in a book on the history of Pennsylvania that Franklin helped compile. As the summer of 1758 approached, Franklin faced two choices. He could return home to his family as planned, but his mission would have been a failure, Or he could instead spend his time traveling through England and enjoying the acclaim he found among his intellectual admirers. There is no sign that Franklin found it a difficult decision. "I have no prospect of returning until next spring," he reported to Deborah rather coolly that June. He would spend the summer, he reported, wandering the countryside. "I depend chiefly on these intended journeys for the establishment of my health." As for Deborah's complaints about her own health, Franklin was only mildly solicitous. "It gives me concern to receive such frequent accounts of your being indisposed, but we both of us grow in years and must expect our constitutions, though tolerably good in themselves, will by degrees give way to the infirmities of age." His letters remained, as always, kindly and chatty, but hardly romantic. They tended to be paternalistic, perhaps a bit condescending at times, and they were certainly not as intellectually engaging as those to his sister Jane Meekham or Polly Stevenson. But they do convey some genuine fondness and even devotion. He appreciated Deborah's sensible practicality and the accommodating nature of their partnership. And for the most part, she seemed accepting of the arrangement they had made long ago and generally content about staying ensconced in her comfortable home and familiar neighborhood, rather than having to follow him on his far-flung travels. Their correspondence contained, until near the end, only occasional reproaches from either side, and he dutifully provided gossip, instructions about how to dismantle his lightning-rod bells, and some old-fashioned advice about women and politics. "You are very prudent not to engage in party disputes," he wrote at one point. "Women should never meddle in them, except in endeavors to reconcile their husbands, brothers, and friends who happen to be on contrary sides. If your sex can keep cool, you may be a means of cooling ours the sooner." Franklin was likewise solicitous, but again only mildly so, about the daughter he had left behind. He expressed his happiness at receiving a portrait of Sally, and he sent her a white hat and cloak, some sundries, and a buckle made of French paste stones. "They cost 3 guineas and are said to be cheap at that price," he wrote. If he felt the tug of his family, it was not particularly strong, because he had a mirror one in London. As he noted in a cavalier postscript to a rambling letter to Deborah that June, "Mrs. Stevenson and her daughter desire me to present their respects." William and the Family Tree. William Franklin, perhaps in reaction to being referred to regularly by his family's enemies as a base-born bastard, had a yearning for social status that was far greater than his father's. Among the most thumbed of his books was one titled The True Conduct of Persons of Quality. And in London he liked to frequent the fashionable homes of the young earls and dukes instead of the coffee houses and intellectual salons favored by his father. Both in his social world and in his legal studies at the Inns of Court, where his father enrolled him, William would eventually be tugged toward a more Tory and loyalist outlook. But the change would be gradual, fitful, and filled with personal conflicts. Before leaving Philadelphia, William had been courting a well-born young debutante named Elizabeth Graham. Her father, Dr. Thomas Graham, a physician and member of the Governor's Council, owned a grand home on Society Hill and a 300-acre country estate considered the finest in the Philadelphia area. Her mother was the stepdaughter of Benjamin Franklin's unreliable patron, Governor Keith. The relationship between the Grahams and the Franklins was strained. Dr. Graham had felt insulted when the elder Franklin did not initially enlist him to run the staff of the new Philadelphia hospital, and he was a close friend of the Penn family in its struggle with the assembly. Nevertheless, with the grudging assent of Dr. Graham, the relationship had progressed to the point where Elizabeth tentatively accepted William's offer of marriage. She was 18, he close to 10 years older. It came with a stipulation. William would withdraw from any involvement in politics. She refused, however, to accompany him to London or to marry him before he left. They would, both agreed, await his return to be married. Once in England, William's ardor for her apparently cooled far more than his ardor for politics. After a short note on his arrival, he did not write her again for 5 months. Gone were the flowery clichés he had once penned about their love, replaced instead with descriptions of the joy of this bewitching country. Worse yet, he proudly sent her the political screed he had signed in the London Chronicle attacking the proprietors, and he went so far as to solicit her opinion of how the article was received back in Philadelphia. Thus ended the relationship. She waited months before sending a cold and bitter response, which labeled him a collection of party malice. The next day he replied through a mutual friend that the fault lay with her fickleness, and he would be glad to see her find happiness with another man. For his part, William was finding his own happiness, both with the fashionable ladies of London and, too much his father's son, occasionally with prostitutes and other women of low repute. Benjamin Franklin, who had mixed emotions about the relationship, seemed unfazed by the breakup. His own hope was that his son would marry Polly Stevenson. There was little chance of that, as William's social aspirations were higher than those of his father. Indeed, William was developing social and financial airs that had begun to worry Franklin. So he began an effort, which would later become a theme in the section of his autobiography that was written ostensibly as a letter to his son, to restrain William from putting on upper-class pretensions. It would ultimately prove futile and become, as much as politics, a cause of their estrangement. Years earlier, Franklin had warned William not to expect much of an inheritance. "I have assured him that I intend to spend what little I have myself," he wrote his own mother. Once in England, Franklin kept a meticulous account of all of William's expenses, including meals, lodging, clothing, and books, with the understanding that they were advances that must someday be repaid. By 1758, even as he was pampering himself a bit with a carriage at Pennsylvania's expense, Franklin was warning his son to be more frugal on meals and to avoid becoming attached to a high style of London living. William, who was traveling with friends in the south of England, was cowed. "I am extremely obliged to you for your care in supplying me with money," he wrote, adding that he had changed his lodgings for something much for the worse, though cheaper. As part of his effort to keep his son rooted in his middling heritage, Franklin took him on a genealogical excursion during the summer of 1758. They traveled to Ecton, about 60 miles northwest of London, where generations of Franklins had lived before Josiah had migrated to America. Still living nearby was Franklin's first cousin, Mary Franklin Fisher, daughter of Josiah's brother Thomas. She was weak with age, Franklin noted, but seems to have been a very smart, sensible woman. At the parish church, the Franklins uncovered 200 years of birth, marriage, and death records of their family. The rector's wife entertained them with stories of Franklin's Uncle Thomas, whose life bore some resemblance to that of his nephew. As Franklin reported to Deborah, "Thomas Franklin was a very leading man in all county affairs and much employed in public business. He set on foot a subscription for erecting chimes in their steeple and completed it, and we heard them play. He found out an easy method of saving their village meadows from being drowned, as they used to be sometimes by the river, which method is still in being. His advice and opinions were sought for on all occasions by all sorts of people, and he was looked upon, she said, by some, as something of a conjurer. He died just 4 years before I was born, on the same day of the same month." Franklin may have noted that the description conjurer was the same that Katy Ray had once used about him. And William, impressed by the coincidence of dates, surmised that a transmigration had occurred. At the cemetery, as William copied data from the gravestones, Franklin's servant, Peter, used a hard brush to scour off the moss. Franklin's account of the scene is a reminder that, as enlightened as he would eventually become, he had brought with him to England 2 slaves. He viewed them, however, more as old family servants than as property. When one of them left soon after they arrived in England, Franklin did not try to force his return, as British law would have allowed. His response to Deborah, when she asked about their welfare later, is revealing. "Peter continues with me, and behaves as well as I can expect in a country where there are many occasions of spoiling servants, if they are ever so good. He has a few faults, as most of them, but I see them with only one eye and hear with only one ear. So we rub on pretty comfortably. King, that you inquire after, is not with us. He ran away from our house near 2 years ago while we were absent in the country, but was soon found in Suffolk, where he had been taken in the service of a lady that was very fond of the merit of making him a Christian and contributing to his education and improvement." As he felt about Peter, so too he felt about slavery for the time being. He saw the faults with only one eye, heard them with only one ear, and rubbed along pretty comfortably, though increasingly less so. The evolution of his views on slavery and race was indeed continuing. He would soon be elected to the board of an English charitable group, the Associates of Dr. Bray, dedicated to building schools for blacks in the colonies. With William in tow, Franklin spent that spring and summer of 1758 wandering England to soak up the hospitality and acclaim of his intellectual admirers. On a visit to Cambridge University, he conducted a series of experiments on evaporation with the renowned chemist John Hadley. Franklin had previously studied how liquids produce different refrigeration effects based on how quickly they evaporate. With Hadley, he experimented using ether, which evaporates very quickly. In a 65-degree room, they repeatedly coated a thermometer bulb with ether and used a bellows to evaporate it. "We continued this operation, one of us wetting the ball and another of the company blowing on it with the bellows to quicken the evaporation, the mercury sinking all the time until it came down to 7, which is 25 degrees below the freezing point," Franklin wrote. "From this experiment one may see the possibility of freezing a man to death on a warm summer's day." He also speculated, correctly, that summer breezes do not by themselves cool people. Instead, the cooling effect comes from the increased evaporation of human perspiration caused by the breeze. His study of heat and refrigeration though not as seminal as his work on electricity, continued throughout his life. In addition to his evaporation experiments, they included further studies of how different colors absorb heat from light, how materials such as metal that conduct electricity are also good at transmitting heat, and how to better design stoves. As usual, his strength was devising not abstract theories but practical applications that could improve everyday life. His visit to Cambridge made such an impression that he was invited back later that summer to view the university's commencement. "My vanity was not a little gratified by the particular regard shown me," he admitted to Deborah. But that regard was not awaiting him when he returned to London in the fall. The Pens Respond. In November 1758, more than a year after Franklin had submitted his heads of complaint, the Pens finally responded. Snubbing Franklin, they had their lawyer, Ferdinand Paris, write directly to the Pennsylvania Assembly with a copy to Franklin, and then followed with a letter of their own to the Assembly. On the issue of the Assembly's power, the proprietors held firm. Their instructions to their governors were inviolable, and the charter gives the power to make laws to the proprietary. The Assembly could provide only advice and consent. On the issue of taxation, however, the Pens held open the possibility of some compromise. "They are very ready to have the annual income of their estate inquired into," Paris wrote, "and consider some contributions based on what is in its nature taxable." The murky response, which offered no concrete assurances of any real money, prompted Franklin to write seeking clarification. But a key aspect of the proprietor's position was that they would not deal with him anymore. Paris pointedly told the Assembly that they had not chosen a person of candor to be their agent. And the Pens, in their own letter, said that further negotiations would require a very different representation. To emphasize the point, Paris visited Franklin personally to deliver the Pens' message that, "We do not think it necessary to keep up a correspondence with a gentleman who acknowledges he is not empowered to conclude proper measures." Franklin answered not a word, Paris reported, and looked as if much disappointed. "Thus a final end is put to all further negotiation between them and me," Franklin wrote Assembly Speaker Norris. His mission stymied, he could have returned home and let others work out the details of a compromise on taxation. So he made a half-hearted offer to resign. "The House will see," he wrote Norris, "that if they propose to continue treating with the proprietors, it will be necessary to recall me and appoint another person or persons for that service who are likely to be more acceptable or more pliant than I am, or, as the proprietors express it, persons of candor." But Franklin did not recommend this approach. His usual pragmatic instincts fell prey to sentiments he had once tried to train himself to avoid, such as bitterness, wounded pride, emotionalism, and political fervor. He proposed instead a radically different alternative. Attempting to take Pennsylvania away from the Pens and turning it into a crown colony under the king and his ministers. If the House, grown at length sensible of the dangers to the liberties of the people necessarily arising from such growing power and property in one family with such principles, shall think it expedient to have the government and property in different hands, and for that purpose shall desire that the crown would take the province into its immediate care, I believe that point might without much difficulty be carried. With some eagerness he concluded, In that I think I could still do service. There was no reason to believe that England's ministers would meddle with the proprietary charter or strike a blow for democracy in the colonies. So why did Franklin fixate on an ill-considered and ill-fated crusade to turn Pennsylvania into a royal colony? Part of the problem was that his animosity toward the Penns had blurred his peripheral vision. To the Yale historian Edmund Morgan, this prolonged fit of political blindness seems surprising, even puzzling. Franklin's preoccupation, not to say obsession, with the proprietary prerogatives not only wasted his immense talents, but obscured his vision and his perceptions of what was politically feasible, he writes. Yet Franklin's actions can be explained, at least partly, by his enthusiasm for the glory of the king's growing empire. Once we fully accept the fact that Franklin, between 1760 and 1764, was an enthusiastic and unabashed royalist who did not and could not foresee the breakup of the empire, then much of the surprise, confusion, and mystery of his behavior in these years falls away, argues Brown University professor Gordon Wood. Others in America were quicker than Franklin to realize that it was the prevailing attitude among most British leaders, and not merely the proprietors, that the colonies ought to be subservient both politically and economically. Franklin's allies in the Pennsylvania Assembly, however, shared his belief that the struggle was with the proprietors, and they agreed he should stay to fight them. So, with no personal desire to leave England, he launched assaults against the Penns on three fronts. The first involved the Penns' handling of Indian affairs. Franklin had long been sympathetic to the rights of the Indians, especially the Delawares, who felt that the Penns had cheated them of land. In the fall of 1758, he submitted a brief on the Delawares' behalf to the Privy Council. In it, he echoed his use of the phrase low jockey that he knew had already enraged the Penns. The Penns, he wrote, had extended their holdings by such arts of jockeyship that gave the Indians the worst of opinions of the English. Little came of Franklin's advocacy, but he helped publicize the case to score propaganda points against the way the Penns managed their colony. Franklin's second line of attack involved a libel case the Pennsylvania Assembly had won against William Smith, the provost of the Academy who had become Franklin's political adversary. When Smith appealed to the Privy Council in London for a reversal, Franklin turned the case into a larger struggle on behalf of the Assembly's rights. Ferdinand Paris represented Smith, arguing that the Assembly of Pennsylvania was not a parliament, nor had anything near so much power as the House of Commons had. In June 1759, the Privy Council ruled against Franklin. On a narrow point, it noted that the Assembly in question had adjourned and a new one been voted in, so the current Assembly had no case. More ominously, it noted that inferior assemblies, like those in the colonies, must not be compared in power or privileges to the House of Commons. On the third issue, Franklin was somewhat more successful. It involved the case of Governor William Denny, who had violated his instruction in a number of cases by approving bills that taxed the proprietor's estates. The Penns, alleging with some evidence that Denny had been bribed, not only recalled him but also appealed to the Privy Council to have the bills nullified. An initial advisory opinion by the Board of Trade went against Franklin and the Assembly. But something surprising happened when the Privy Council heard the appeal. Lord Mansfield, a member of the council, beckoned Franklin to join him in the clerk's office while the lawyers were arguing. Was he really of the opinion that the taxes could be levied in such a way that did not injure the Penn estates? Certainly, Franklin replied.
Then, said Lord Mansfield, you can have little objection to enter into an engagement to assure that point.
None at all, said Franklin. Thus, a compromise was reached. Franklin agreed that the Assembly's tax bill would exclude the unsurveyed wastelands belonging to the proprietors and would tax unsettled land at a rate no higher than similar land owned by others. By reverting to his old pragmatism, Franklin had won a partial victory. But the compromise did not settle permanently the issue of the Assembly's power, nor did it restore harmony between it and the proprietors. The compromise also did nothing to further Franklin's crusade to strip the Penns of their proprietorship of Pennsylvania. Quite the contrary. In all of its rulings, the Privy Council showed no inclination to alter the charter of the proprietors. Nor had Franklin succeeded in whipping up any public support for such a course. Once again, he faced a situation in which there was little more he could achieve in England, and no real reason he could not return home. Yet once again, Franklin felt no inclination to leave. Densest happiness. Among Franklin's greatest joys were his summer travels. In 1759, he and William went to Scotland, their path paved with introductions to the intellectual elite from William Strawn and John Pringle, both Edinburgh natives. He stayed at the manor of Sir Alexander Dick, a renowned physician and scientist, and there met the greats of the Scottish Enlightenment, the economist Adam Smith, the philosopher David Hume, and the jurist and historian Lord Kames. One night at dinner, Franklin regaled the guests with one of his best literary hoaxes, a biblical chapter he fabricated called the Parable Against Persecution. It told of Abraham giving food and shelter to a 198-year-old man, then throwing him out when he said he did not believe in Abraham's God. The parable concluded, "And at midnight God called upon Abraham, saying, 'Abraham, where is the stranger?' And Abraham answered and said, 'Lord, he would not worship thee, neither would he call upon thy name. Therefore have I driven him out before my face into the wilderness.' And God said, 'Have I borne with him these 198 years, and nourished him, and clothed him, notwithstanding his rebellion against me? And couldst thou not, that art thyself a sinner, bear with him one night?'" The guests, charmed by Franklin and his philosophy of tolerance, asked him to send them copies, which he did. It was also at this time that Franklin wrote Hume about the tale of the dispute over a maypole, which involved a Lord Marshal who had been asked to opine on whether all forms of damnation were for eternity. Franklin compared it to the plight of a mayor in a Puritan Massachusetts village, who was called on to resolve a dispute between those who wanted to erect a maypole and others who considered it blasphemous. "He heard their altercation with great patience, and then gravely determined thus: 'You that are for having no maypole shall have no maypole, and you that are for having a maypole shall have a maypole. Get about your business, and let me hear no more of this quarrel.' So methinks Lord Marshal might say,
You, that are for no more damnation than is proportioned to your offences, have my consent that it may be so. And you, that are for being damned eternally, God eternally damn you all, and let me hear no more of your disputes. David Hume was the greatest British philosopher of his era, and one of the most important logical and analytical thinkers of all time. He had already written the two seminal tracts, A Treatise of Human Nature and Essays Concerning Human Understanding, that are now considered among the most important works in the development of empirical thought, placing him in the pantheon with Locke and Berkeley. When Franklin met him, he was completing the 6-volume History of England that would make him rich and famous. Franklin assiduously courted him and helped convert him to the colonial cause. "I am not a little pleased to hear of your change of sentiments in some particulars relating to America," Franklin subsequently wrote him, adding as flattery, "I know no one that has it more in his power to rectify the British misunderstandings." Of one of Hume's essays favoring free trade with the colonies, Franklin enthused that it would have a good effect in promoting a certain interest too little thought of by selfish man. I mean the interest of humanity, or common good of mankind. Franklin and Hume also shared an interest in language. When Hume berated him for coining new words, Franklin agreed to quit using the terms colonize and unshakable. But he lamented that, "I cannot but wish the usage of our tongue permitted making new words when we want them." For example, Franklin argued, the word inaccessible was not nearly as good as coining a new word such as uncomatible. Hume's response to this suggestion is unknown, but it did nothing to diminish his ardent admiration for his new friend. "America has sent us many good things, gold, silver, sugar, tobacco, indigo," he wrote back. "But you are the first philosopher, and indeed the first great man of letters, for whom we are beholden to her." During his visit to Scotland, Franklin also became friends with Henry Home, Lord Kames, whose interests ranged from farming and science to literary criticism and history. Among the things they discussed on their horseback rides through the countryside was the need for Britain to keep control of Canada, which had been wrested from the French earlier that year when an Anglo-American force captured Quebec in one of the decisive battles of the French and Indian War. "Franklin pushed the case not merely as I am a colonist, but as I am a Briton." As he wrote Kames soon after his departure, "The future grandeur and stability of the British Empire lie in America." For all his problems with the pens, he had not yet turned into a rebel. The visit to Scotland was capped by Franklin's acceptance of an honorary doctorate from the University of St. Andrews. As the crimson silk and white satin robe was draped over his shoulder, Franklin was read a citation praising the rectitude of his morals and sweetness of his life and conversation. It added, "By his ingenious inventions and successful experiments, with which he has enriched the science of natural philosophy, and more especially of electricity, which heretofore was little known, he has acquired so much praise throughout the world as to deserve the greatest honors in the Republic of Letters." Thereafter, he was often referred to, even by himself, as Dr. Franklin. The time he spent in Scotland, he wrote Lord Kames on his way home, was 6 weeks of the densest happiness I have met with in any part of my life. This was perhaps a small exaggeration, but it helped explain why he was not hurrying back to Philadelphia.
Indeed, by early 1760, Franklin was beginning to harbor some hope that Deborah and Sally would join him in England. His dream, now that he realized William was unlikely to marry Polly Stevenson, was another middle-class union. To have Sally, marry William Strawn's son Billy. It was a match he had fantasized about when Sally was a mere toddler and Strawn was someone he knew only through his letters. Although arranged marriages were no longer prevalent, they were not uncommon, and Strawn proposed in writing a plan to unite their children. Franklin passed it along to Deborah tentatively, assuming that it was unlikely to entice her over. "I received the enclosed some time since from Mr. Strawn. I afterwards spent an evening in conversation with him on the subject. He was very urgent with me to stay in England and prevail with you to move hither with Sally. He proposed several advantageous schemes to me which appeared reasonably founded. His family is a very agreeable one. Mrs. Strawn, a sensible and good woman, the children of amiable characters, and particularly the young man, who is sober, ingenious and industrious, and a desirable person. In point of circumstances, there can be no objection, Mr. Strawn being in so thriving a way as to lay up £1,000 every year from the profits of his business, after maintaining his family and paying all charges. I gave him, however, two reasons why I could not think of removing hither. One, my affection to Pennsylvania and long-established friendships and other connections there. The other, your invincible aversion to crossing the seas. Sally was almost 17, and the union held out a promise of a comfortable life in a smart and fun circle. But Franklin left the decision up to his wife. I thanked him for the regard shown us in the proposal, but gave him no expectation that I should forward the letters, he wrote. So you are at liberty to answer or not, as you think proper. There is no indication that Deborah was tempted in the least. As for William, Franklin was not only a bad matchmaker, he was an even worse role model. Around this time, probably in February 1760, William followed in his father's steps by siring an illegitimate son, William Temple Franklin, known as Temple. His mother was apparently a woman of the streets who, like William's own mother, seems never to have been heard from again. William accepted paternity, but instead of promptly finding a wife and taking him home, as his own father had done, he sent the child to be raised secretly by a foster family. Temple would eventually become a treasured grandchild to Benjamin Franklin, who oversaw his education and then brought him under his wing as a personal secretary. Later, when his grandfather and father were on opposite sides during the Revolutionary War, Temple would become a pawn in a heart-wrenching struggle for his loyalty and devotion, one that Benjamin Franklin would win at great personal cost. But for the time being, he was kept out of sight while William enjoyed the social whirl of London and more excursions with his celebrated father. The most memorable was a trip to the continent in the summer of 1761. Because Britain was still at war with France, they traveled instead to Holland and Flanders. Franklin noted with pleasure that the observance of religion there was not as strict as in America, especially when it came to observing Sundays as the Sabbath. In the afternoon, both high and low went to the play or the opera, where there was plenty of singing, fiddling, and dancing, he reported to a Connecticut friend. I looked around for God's judgments, but saw no signs of them. He concluded with a touch of amusement that this provided evidence that the Lord did not care so much about preventing pleasure on the Sabbath as the strict Puritans would have people believe. The happiness and prosperity in Flanders, he wrote, would almost make one suspect that the deity is not so angry at that offense as a New England justice. Franklin's fame as a scientist meant that he was celebrated wherever he went. In Brussels, Prince Charles of Lorraine's showed them the equipment he had bought to replicate Franklin's electricity experiments. And in Leiden, a meeting of the world's two great electricians occurred. Franklin spent time with Peter van Musselbroek, inventor of the Leyden jar. The professor said he was about to publish a book that would make use of a letter Franklin had sent him about electricity, but alas, he died just 2 weeks after the Franklins left. Canada and Empire. Franklin cut short his trip to the continent to come back to London to attend the coronation of King George III in September 1761. Still very much a proud British royalist, he harbored high hopes for the new king, and fancied that he might protect the colonies from the tyranny of the proprietors. In America, the French and Indian War had pretty much ended, with England and her colonies capturing control of Canada and many of the Caribbean sugar islands belonging to France and Spain. In Europe, however, the broader struggle between Britain and France, known as the Seven Years' War, would not be resolved until a Treaty of Paris was signed in 1763. Franklin's ardor for the expansion of the king's empire led him to continue his crusade to convince Britain to keep control of Canada rather than cede it back to France in return for some Caribbean islands as part of a negotiated settlement. In an anonymous article in Strawn's London Chronicle, he used his old trick of parody and produced 10 facetious reasons why Canada should be restored to France. Among them, "We should restore Canada because an uninterrupted trade with the Indians throughout a vast country where the communication by water is so easy would increase our commerce already too great. We should restore it lest, through a greater plenty of beaver, broad-brimmed hats become cheaper to that unmannerly sect, the Quakers. We should restore Canada, that we may soon have another war, and another opportunity of spending 2 or 3 millions a year in America, there being great danger of our growing too rich." On a far more serious note, he produced a 58-page pamphlet entitled "The Interest of Great Britain Considered with Regard to Her Colonies," in which he argued that keeping control of Canada would benefit the British Empire and help protect its American colonies from constant harassment by the French and their Indian allies. "To leave the French in possession of Canada, when it is in our power to remove them," he wrote, "seems neither safe nor prudent." The pamphlet dwelled in great detail on the issue of Canada, but it also raised an even more important topic: the relationship between Britain and her colonies. Franklin wrote as a man who was still a loyal, indeed an ardent, supporter of the empire, "Happy as we now are under the best of kings." The inhabitants of the colonies, he argued, were anxious for the glory of her crown, the extent of her power and commerce, the welfare and future repose of the whole British people. "The best way to assure continued harmony," he wrote, "was to provide safe and abundant land so that the colonies could expand." Franklin had a theory about the underlying cause of the growing friction between Britain and her colonies, one that he first expressed 9 years earlier in his Observations Concerning the Increase of Mankind. The conflicts, he believed, grew from the attitude of the British mercantilists, who had something in common with the proprietors. They viewed the colonies as a market to be exploited. Consequently, they opposed the development of manufacturing in the colonies, as well as greater rights of self-government. In the pamphlet, he noted his fear that this attitude could even provoke the future independence of our colonies. The best way to make America prosperous, without turning it into a manufacturing center, Franklin said, was to keep Canada and thus assure there was always an abundance of land for the colonists to settle. No man who can have a piece of land of his own, sufficient by his labor to subsist his family in plenty, is poor enough to be a manufacturer and work for a master, he wrote. Hence, while there is enough land in America for our people, there can never be manufacturers of any amount or value. An expanding America would thus always provide a market for British goods. He also argued that as long as Britain avoided tyranny and oppression, there was no danger of the colonies rebelling. While the government is mild and just, while important civil and religious rights are secure, such subjects will be dutiful and obedient. Then he provided a metaphor that drew from his studies of turbulent waters. The waves do not rise but when the winds blow. Britain would therefore be best served, he concluded, by treating the people of the colonies as full citizens of the empire, with the same liberties and rights and economic aspirations. He would, in the end, fail to sell the British ministry on this expansive vision of imperial harmony. But he and others who argued for Britain's retention of Canada did prevail. Bittersweet Farewell. In the summer of 1762, 5 years after his arrival, Franklin finally decided it was time to return home. He was torn. He loved his life in England. Both the acclaim, he had just been awarded an honorary doctorate at Oxford, and the friends and surrogate family he had made. But the decision was made a bit easier because he assumed that he would soon be back. The attraction of reason is at present for the other side of the water, but that of inclination will be for this side, he wrote Strawn. You know which usually prevails. Indeed, his inclination to be in England would prevail again within 2 years. He was, however, too optimistic about both his personal and public life when he added, I shall probably make but this one vibration and settle here forever. Nothing will prevent it if I can, as I hope I can, prevail with Mrs. F. to accompany me. William was ready to return as well, and he needed a job. He had applied for appointment as Deputy Secretary of North Carolina and inquired about opportunities in the Customs Service and the Caribbean. But luck and good connections ended up producing something surprisingly better. The Royal Governor of New Jersey had just been recalled, and his presumed replacement decided to decline the post. Acting quietly to avoid alerting the Penns, William successfully lobbied for the job with the help of his father's friend John Pringle, who was the doctor and close advisor of the new Prime Minister, Lord Bute. When news of the pending appointment became public, the Penns surreptitiously tried to derail it by spreading word that he was a bastard, but to no avail. William's appointment was partly an attempt by Bute and others to assure the loyalty of William's famous father. But there is no sign that the elder Franklin did much to help his son. Years later, Franklin would tell his friends in France that he had tried to dissuade his son from pursuing the post, or any appointed patronage position, by telling him of the time as a child when he had paid too much for a whistle. "Think of what the whistle may one day cost you," he said to William. "Why not become a joiner or a wheelwright, if the estate I leave you is not enough? The man who lives by his labor is at least free." William, however, had become infatuated with the title Excellency as a way to emerge from his father's shadow. In possession of a public job, William was in need of a wife. So, at the same time he was securing his appointment, he was making plans to marry a sweet and well-born planter's daughter, Elizabeth Downs, a fixture of high Tory society whom he had met at the balls of London. His father had trouble extinguishing all hope that William would marry Polly Stevenson, but he finally gave his consent and approbation to the marriage. In a letter to his sister Jane, Franklin professed to be pleased by William's new appointment, and even more by his marriage. "The lady is of so amiable a character that the latter gives me more pleasure than the former, though I have no doubt but that he will make as good a governor as husband, for he has good principles and good dispositions, and I think is not deficient in good understanding." Yet Franklin, usually so fond of younger ladies and surrogate family members, did not warm up to Elizabeth and never would. Franklin was, in fact, unenthusiastic about, perhaps even bothered by, his son's successes. William's marriage to an upper-class woman was a declaration of independence, and his appointment as governor meant he was no longer subservient to his father. Indeed, it meant that William, then about 31, would have a station in life higher than his father's, one that would likely reinforce his son's unattractive tendency to adopt elitist airs and pretenses. A cloud was coming over the horizon, and there was no lightning rod to diffuse its emotional charge.